joy to let you all know that we've surpassed our initial goal of $25,000 and have raised a little over $30,000 to date. As always, we're accepting donations year-round. Thank you to our listeners for continuing to support Grassroots Community Media. Your donations and support underline our mandate of people-powered radio. If you made a pledge but have not yet paid, please do so by May 1st to be eligible for our prize draw.
Amanda broadcast tonight is a replaying of our program from 27 January this year.
Good evening, Amandla and Amandla listeners around the world. Welcome to Amandla, our weekly African current affairs program, produced both in English and in French, on air since 1987 here at CKUT 90.3. My name is Helden, and as usual, I'm sitting virtually across from Doug and Gwen. And how are you guys doing today? And if you could talk about what we have lined up today on this lovely last Wednesday of January 2021.
Thank you, Helden. So Doug and I had an opportunity to interview Fareed Omar, who is a longstanding contributor to Amandla. He's a member of the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa. And we re-interviewed him today about the situation in Ethiopia. So we had spoken to him a few weeks back. And today, on the basis of an article that he wrote on the role of neoliberalism in this conflict, we had an opportunity to talk to him more pointedly about that. But he also fills us in on the background of what is a spectacularly complex issue that is not just within Ethiopia's borders, but is becoming a sprawling regional issue. So we'll be playing that tonight. And then,
well, I took the opportunity because he's so well informed about the whole Horn of Africa and East Africa situation. I took the opportunity to query him about the recent Ugandan election, and as ever, he was clear, concise, articulate, and very positive about youth. My goodness gracious. So stay tuned to Amandla.
One youth and youth, you know, a politician, we're comfy born. Straight from the dangle, I come and share with comfy space. Exactly what's on a poor man's mind. Man called Bobby One, a man called Nobby, and listen, we comfy talk. Remember, we are good to you. Watch this.
Welcome back, Amandla. Welcome back to Amandla. You can listen to us on CKUT 90.3 or even on our website, amandla.ca. But to come back to tonight, I know that, Gwen, you had something for us.
Okay, well, as I said earlier in the introduction, Doug and I had the opportunity to talk extensively with Fareed Omar about Ethiopia and Uganda. We're going to kick off tonight with the discussion that we had with him about Ethiopia. I mean, Doug, it was tremendous in the sense that he provided us with a lot of background explaining just the complexity of the number of parties involved in this issue, how it is spreading. You know, it's now there's Sudanese involvement. There's Egyptian involvement, the United Arab Emirates, Somali child soldiers, Eritrea is involved. I mean, it really, really threatens to become a sprawling regional conflict if it does not get mediated sooner rather than later.
Oh, yes. And he had already given us a fairly broad overview of all of that about a month and a half ago. So we took the opportunity to get him to do us a sort of briefer summary to bring us up to date, but also bring us into the picture again. And then we moved to a second part with him because he wrote an article just recently that appeared in Canadian Dimension. And a couple other places where he links the fact that going on in Ethiopia is an internal struggle that is pitting neoliberalism against the setup that had been established with the help of the Chinese and the East Asian community for what would have been what he calls, I'm going to get this wrong,
The developmental state,
where the government is the owner and director of how development will be established, big parastatal corporations, and even the military was owned quite a wide variety of parts of the economy. But how under neoliberalism with World Bank and IMF influence, they'll be selling off all of that. So let's let Fareed explain it because he's way more informed and articulate than I am.
Hi, Fareed. Welcome back to Amandla.
Okay.
We spoke at length about the conditions that had led to the war in Tigray, or between Ethiopian Central State and Tigray province. Could you just give us a brief background on the origins of this war, the most recent manifestation of it?
Yeah, the most recent is that on November 4th, the government of Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed launched a military offensive in the Tigray region to topple the ruling regional government, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, TPLF, which previously ruled Ethiopia as part of a coalition, the EP, Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front. The reason given by the government was that the TPLF in the north, in Mekele, in the capital, attacked the northern military command in that region. But that's not the trigger of this conflict. It was just one of the main reasons why the government took that action. But the main triggers were started long before that, since the ouster of TPLF from power. And when Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018, immediately he came to power in April 2018, he saw the TPLF as a threat. He was part of a coalition that ruled Ethiopia at that time, but a minor one. He was part of the Oromo People's Party, Oromo People's Democratic Party, which is part of the EPDRF coalition. So he saw the TPLF as a threat, and he started purging senior government officials from the TPLF and also military officials from state and government. And then most of the TPLF elite retreated to Mekele, the capital of Tigray region, to defend themselves from what they saw as an onslaught by the Abiy Ahmed government. And then in August last year, the TPLF held its regional elections, which were due. Actually, it was in September, but they were due in August across Ethiopia. Elections were due across Ethiopia last August, but the Abiy Ahmed government used the coronavirus as a pretext to postpone that election. So the PLF held their own elections in September. The government saw this as defiance, and it also led to further tensions between the TPLF and the Abiy Ahmed government. And then when about 3 to 4 months before November last year, the Ethiopian forces were mobilizing to attack Tigray. So troops were being brought from all over the country, from different regions, from different states of Ethiopia. Not only federal troops, but also some militias were being mobilized, especially the Amhara militias that are allied to the Abiy Ahmed government, and also what they call in Ethiopia special EU police forces that are paramilitary forces that are usually deployed in regional states. So the EU police were brought from different regions, let's say like from the Somali region, from Oromia region, but the bulk of them came from the Amhara state. So all these forces were being mobilized to attack Tigray. Not only that, Abiy Ahmed government struck a deal with Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea to help them to fight Tigray, because the TPLF, after ruling Ethiopia for almost 30 years, had a very strong, powerful army made up of 250,000 fighters, and it also had a very heavy weaponry.
Now, so these are Tigrayans, are they?
Yeah, Tigrayans, yeah.
Okay, yes. And that's opposed to the federal force, which is made up
exactly.
From all over.
As opposed to the federal forces. The Abiy Ahmed government knew they cannot fight the TPLF on their own. This is the federal government of Ethiopia recognizing that they cannot fight the TPLF on its own. So they have to enlist the support of Eritrea and regional forces, and also the support of militias, like especially the Amhara regional state militias. So that's how the war started. So they attacked Mekelle. First of all, in the border, most of the fighting took along the border regions, but because Eritrea also had a very powerful army, a battle-hardened army, they attacked from the east, and then there were drone attacks. This one was by the UAE. The UAE, from early on, was part of this conflict. They have commercial interests in Ethiopia, especially they're looking for oil concessions, but also agricultural concessions. And when Abiy Ahmed came to power right away in the beginning, in the early days, UAE granted Ethiopia $3 billion in aid, and the whole purpose was to have unfettered access to Ethiopia's resources. So Eritrea also used, and Ethiopia, they used a lot of air bombardments, and a lot of civilian infrastructure were destroyed. They were not targeting only military targets, but also civilian targets, and a lot of civilians were killed. And thousands of civilians fled to Sudan. It created a refugee crisis right away. And I think by now, almost they are close to 60,000 or even more of Ethiopian refugees, mainly Tigrayan. But also there were Eritrean refugees who are based in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. These are refugees from the 1998 the 2000 war.
Eritreans fleeing the government of Eritrea.
Yes, exactly. Also fleeing, and also fleeing dictatorships in Afwerki's dictatorship. So also these refugees were affected, and they found themselves once again on the move, fleeing across the border to Sudan. So the conflict has created a humanitarian crisis.
Well, and it's quite apart from the internally displaced people from within the country who are being moved by the war.
Yes, exactly.
But the regional implications have also expanded. Eritrea has dragged Somalia in, apparently.
Oh, yes. And this is very sad. Somalia, which for decades now has been struggling with its own security issues, was dragged into this conflict. In late 2018, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia, they signed a tripartite agreement of cooperation, economic cooperation and security. When it comes to security, in the case of Somalia, it was agreed that Eritrea will train Somali troops, but not to fight other wars, but these troops will be brought back to Somalia once they complete training. And to help in the fight against the insurgency. But There are about 3,000 to 4,000 Somali troops that were being trained in Eritrea, and suddenly enough, majority of them are child soldiers. We hear about kids ages from 14, 15, 16 years old drafted into this training. So they knew that they will be trained and then sent back home. But when the war started, they were forcibly forced to go and fight in Mekele and other parts of Tigray against their own will. And because they were ill-trained, ill-equipped, they suffered heavy casualties. Like, we hear reports coming out from Somalia that probably thousands of them were killed. And right now there are about 168 of them injured in hospitals in Bahir Dar, which is the capital of the regional Amhara state. So Somalia was clandestinely pushed into this war. And a lot of Somali moms whose kids were sent to this war are demonstrating all over the country, especially in Mogadishu, demanding answers. They want their kids to be brought back. The chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Somali Parliament has also demanded investigation, and so is opposition leader, one of the key opposition leaders, Abdi Shakur Abdurrahman. So they are demanding investigation into this matter. So Somalia has been drawn into this. Somalia should not be fighting this war. Eritrea should not be fighting this war. No other country should be involved in this war. There should have been no war in the first place. The issue in Tigray should have been solved peacefully. Even the Tigrayan leaders were ready to negotiate with the Abiy Ahmed government. They sent overtures, a lot of overtures before the conflict broke out. And so we see now the conflict. And before the war, Abiy was warned by many analysts that due to regional dimensions and regional geopolitical issues in the Horn of Africa, in which a lot of countries, their issues are interconnected in terms of security and geopolitical strategies, it can draw in neighboring countries like Eritrea, Sudan, and far away Egypt as well. And now we see there's another front now. Sudanese forces have attacked Sudan.
Sudanese forces have attacked who?
For the last 3 weeks, there have been a war going on between Sudanese and Ethiopian forces because they have a territorial dispute. Because Abiy didn't realize that when he ignites a war in such a volatile region that has a lot of flashpoints. Some of these flashpoints, internal border disputes within Ethiopia's regions, but also external border disputes. Ethiopia has border disputes with Eritrea. That is still yet to be solved because the Badme enclave that Ethiopia and Eritrea fought for in the late 90s is part of Tigray. It's located inside Tigray. And then Sudan and Ethiopia have a border dispute over a stretch of land called Al-Fashaka. Al-Fashaka is historically a Sudanese territory, but over the last 2-3 decades, it was occupied by Ethiopian farmers. It is a very fertile arable land. And so what is Sudan did, Sudan took advantage of the conflict in Tigray and it sent troops to Al-Fashaka. So the Sudanese troops have recovered the entire Al-Fashaka territory, driving out Ethiopian farmers, but also Ethiopian troops that were stationed there, Ethiopian troops and also the Amhara regional militias. They were all driven out of Al-Fashaka. Now we hear that Sudan has not only taken over Al-Fashaka, but their troops are 50 kilometers inside Ethiopian territory. I think this is likely an attempt by Sudan to set up a buffer zone along its border with Sudan, and this can lead to an all-out war between Sudan.
Boy, this is really getting messy. What about the rail line to Djibouti?
Djibouti has wisely stayed out of this conflict, but there are also flashpoints when it's come to Djibouti, especially with the Afar question. As you know, that in the Afar state of Djibouti has, as its western neighbor, the Afar state in Ethiopia. And then there is the Afar minority populations inside Djibouti that are traditionally repressed. So what happened recently was that militias from the Afar region attacked the Somali region in Ethiopia, which borders Djibouti. And there is still some fighting going on alongside the Afar region and the Somali region of Ethiopia between Liyu regional forces of both states. The fighting is still going on back and forth. So if this fighting intensifies, it may draw in Djibouti, because this fighting is taking very close near the Djibouti border in a district called City. So that's the situation as far as Djibouti is concerned. But we haven't talked about Egypt yet. I think 3 weeks ago, Sudanese defense officials had a meeting with Egyptian defense officials in Cairo. And then it was followed up by another meeting, similar meeting in Sudan. And in late November, Egypt sent forces to Sudan, and they said the purpose was to conduct a joint military exercise between Egypt and Sudan. And they did conduct a military exercise, including Air Force war games. So it happened. Some Egyptian troops are still stationed inside Sudan. As you know, Egypt had issues with Ethiopia over the construction of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, of which Ethiopia has recently been filling up that dam. And Egypt relies on 90% for its water needs on the Nile. So it sees any encroachment on its quota of the water, Nile waters, as a declaration of war. And in fact, Egypt considers issues pertaining to the Nile as a national security issue. So what's happening now is that a lot of people feel Egypt is pushing Sudan to escalate the conflict in Ethiopia. And if an all-out war breaks between Ethiopia and Sudan, then Egypt will invade. With the purpose is to take over the dam in Benkashul region. Benkashul is a state that borders Sudan, where the dam is located. And this dam is located only 40 kilometers from the Sudanese border. And inside Benkashul state, where the dam is located, a lot of fighting is going on. There are militias from the Benkashul who are fighting Ethiopian federal forces, because people in the Benkashul region have always wanted greater autonomy, and they have been at the receiving end of Addis Ababa. They felt repressed. So now they took up arms, and their militias have been able to push out Ethiopian forces. And people wonder how did this happen. Most likely, I think they received military support from Sudan. And soon, there's a fear that Benkashul may be encouraged to break away from Ethiopia to enable Sudan and Ethiopia to take complete control of that dam, which lies within the Benkashul territory. So it's another very serious flashpoint, Benkashul area. And the fighting in Benkashul is still continuing, very heavy fighting in that region as well.
And so this is somewhat indicative. Now you've painted the picture here in the northern eastern side of it, but it's all over Ethiopia that we see these internal disputes going on, whether it's the south and the east or west.
Yes.
the group. So Ethiopia is in a major crisis situation, and it has turned around, apparently. If we go back to a Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago, it's turned around rather rapidly. What's going on now? This takes us to our next question, the article you just wrote more recently about neoliberalism being a factor in this. Now, we've been fighting neoliberalism for 30 plus years, if not more. How has it reared its head again in Ethiopia, and how has it influenced this this struggle?
When Abiy Ahmed came to power, he felt that his biggest immediate threat was the TPLF. In early 2018, they were still in power before they, they were still in government before they retreated to Mekelle. And he realized the TPLF main power was the development state that was built by the late Zenawi with the support of China. So the rise of the development state in Ethiopia is crucial in terms of learning, understanding the current conflict.
Okay, could you just draw the picture of what that development state looks like then?
Yeah.
Can you draw a portrait of what had been developed over the period of the developmental state that was ruled over by the TPLF, despite it being a consortium, an ethnic amalgam, was still the TPLF that was in control.
Yes, the development state was built by Zenawi with the support of China. It largely involved building an infrastructure project, large infrastructure projects like the Djibouti Addis Ababa Railway, which was built by China with the help of China. It cost around $3 billion. And then there was the Addis Ababa LRT, which cost close to $1 billion, $800 million. And then there was the Hawassa Industrial Park in the south, which has about 52 production units that can accommodate up to 30 foreign companies, while the Hawassa Industrial Park largely focuses on textiles and garments, but Ethiopia has 10 other such industrial parks. The development state also included the expansion of state-controlled monopolies. These were in the form of state enterprises. So they included the Ethiopia Telecom, which is one of the largest in Africa because it has about 60 million subscribers. And then there's the Ethiopian Electric Power Corporation, which runs about 12 hydroelectric plants. And then the Ethiopian Sugar Corporation, which is state-owned as well, which also makes Ethiopia one of the largest sugar producers in the continent. And then there is the Ethiopian Railway Corporation, which is also state-owned. Ethiopian Airlines, which has always been state-owned, was expanded during the TPLF rule. And then there's another one, a big one, gigantic one, the Metals and Engineering Corporation, METEC. METEC is a military-owned conglomerate, which manufactures military equipment, but also civilian products like solar panels, trucks, construction material, plastic products, and more. On top of that, the development state included the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which cost about $4.7 billion to construct, but largely from domestic bonds. So we saw this development taking place starting early 2000s until now, so until the end of the TPLF rule.
So the logic here is that it's a state-governed and state-driven development.
Development, yes.
and that state owned, of course, and this is what they used to call the model of the Asian tigers, the South Asian or East Asian and the Chinese state running big corporations, but them running then like businesses.
Exactly. So this actually, the Ethiopian developmental state was modeled loosely along the Chinese and East Asian models, the Asian tiger models. But it only benefited the Tigrayan elite. So the development did not trickle down to the masses, although there were improvements in the social infrastructure. For example, during the development state, a lot of people gained more access to education, healthcare, and water than ever before, but still, the majority of people, Ethiopian people, live at the margins of society. They live in abject poverty.
So but huge disparities, despite...
Yes, exactly. The only thing it was able to put out there was massive infrastructure, like roads and highways were built. A lot of areas in rural Ethiopia now are accessible better than before, but still, it was a state-driven and state-controlled, and only benefited mostly the Tigrayan elite.
Now, the arrival of Abiy, yes. has turned that around, and that's where we're talking neoliberalism. So, for our listeners, bring us back into identify neoliberalism. What is it looking like here?
Yeah, with neoliberalism, Abiy Ahmed decided to pursue this path because he saw that it was the only way to dismantle the development state. And for his party, then his newly formed party, he was able to dismantle the old party, the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, the coalition, and he set up a party called PP, Prosperity Party, which is made up of close allies, hand-picked allies of Abiy Ahmed. So he decided that the only way to dismantle the development state is to pursue the neoliberal path.
But why would he want to dismantle it when it has been apparently accomplishing great infrastructure achievements over the last two decades?
Because the Tigrayan elite was still in control, and also in especially in the Tigray region, the development state was still in effect. There was no way he could allow for the TPLF elite in Ethiopia to have more power. And that's where much of the power of the TPLF came from. And he decided that he should seek Western aid to try and dismantle the development state.
So this developmental state was done without Western aid. It was done...
Yeah, with Chinese aid.
Chinese aid, okay.
With Chinese aid, yeah. Abiy Ahmed himself, he said that in 2019, he told the Financial Times that his economic model is capitalism. So in 2019, December 2019, after the Davos meeting, the World Economic Forum summit, in which he attended, and in which he pitched Western powers to invest in Ethiopia. Ethiopia was granted $9 billion aid from the World Bank and IMF to implement privatization and liberalization of the economy. So he actually dismantled the development state to privatize those public assets because they were still controlled by the TPLF elites. Most of these public enterprises were still in the hands of TPLF elites. And the only way he could dislodge them from these state-owned corporations, these public assets, is to privatize them. So, and hence his decision to pursue a neoliberal path to start dismantling the development state. So a lot of these corporations are up for privatization now.
And in fact, this falls perfectly into the Western resentment of China's massive move into Africa generally, but Ethiopia in particular. And then takes us right back to what we remember from the 80s and 90s, where water, electricity, transport, everything will be sold off willy-nilly.
Yes.
To private enterprise, and then we have inequalities rising still.
Exactly. So actually, one of the conditions of IB getting $9 billion in aid from the IMF and World Bank was to privatize these public assets to allow Western corporations to come in to buy off, to sell off these assets to Western corporation, to liberalize the economy, to create incentives for foreign Western investors to come in. And he kick-started the process across Ethiopia. And because he has to implement it uniformly across Ethiopia, it meant he has to dismantle it.
So Farid, because Abiy Ahmed was so keen to dislodge the leadership of the TPLF, who were still entrenched in power in Tigray, and who still had considerable, obviously, in their 20-year rule of Ethiopia, they'd invested heavily in their home state. So they still had a large component of developmental state in their province. So he felt he had to dismantle it there in order to finally take down the TPLF as a power source.
Yes, so that's the only way to break down TPLF power is to dismantle the developmental state, which he saw as the main source of TPLF power. So that's why he decided to pursue neoliberalism and Western aid to bring in a new order into Ethiopia. With the developmental state intact, it could have been difficult for him to exact power the way he wanted. And he was also being pushed by new forces from within the Ethiopian elite who are angling for privatization of public assets. They wanted to control part of this state enterprise for a long time. The indigenous capitalist class as well. So he initiated this conflict in Tigray to dismantle the remaining vestiges of the diplomatic state. The state is still not completely dismantled, but according to his view, according to Abiy Ahmed, he decided that he has to dismantle the developmental state in order to defeat the TPLF once and for all.
Well, he's not going to dismantle it in 1 year because it's a huge infrastructure we're talking about built up over 20 years, and it requires bits and pieces of dismantling, and not that you can't just do it in one.
He can do it. The only way he can do it is to sell off this asset. That is his plan, to sell off to sell off these assets to Western corporations, and a few of them to indigenous capital. So that is and with the support of the IMF and World Bank, he's trying to move in that direction, and this will worsen the situation. The conflict in Ethiopia, because, as you know, neoliberalism will lead to deprivation and mass poverty. The government state in Tigray, because and civil unrest across the country, and it has happened many across Africa before, whereby when people are deprived by exploitative imperialist economic forces. They resist. Some of them even take up arms. So that's what's happening in Ethiopia now. Like, there's a lot of forces that also are also opposed to the neoliberal economic doctrine, because they feel that they will lose access to state services. They will lose, it will lead to retrenchment of the civil service. A lot of people will lose jobs. It will drive wages down. So
cut back in services, and what,
yes, exactly,
the feeble health system and education system is there will be even more weakened.
Yeah, well, especially public education and public healthcare will suffer as a result of privatization.
Yes, Gwen.
So yes, I'm wondering about the Chinese and all of this, because certainly under the previous regime that was closely tied to Chinese investment, and the Chinese were obviously benefiting from privileged access to Ethiopian resources. So where are the Chinese in this this whole scenario that you're setting out for us that involves so many players and is so complex? Did they just kind of pack up and go home, or are they in any way involved in how this whole situation is evolving?
Well, they're actually looking at their creations being sold to the West.
I know, but my question is there a pushback from them? Are they attempting to influence the outcome of this conflict? Are they playing a role, you know, in terms of these greater powers that are involved in this situation? Are they playing any kind of role, or are they just keeping quiet?
Until now, I think they have quite quiet. But one thing we can note is that in the Somali region, where they had oil concessions, all the production has stopped in the last 3-4 months. Production, the oil production that was led by Chinese corporations has all but stopped in that region. So it looks like things are changing, and we don't know how China will respond to this. But if they feel that their interests are threatened, then there could be likelihood that they could support the TPLF in some way, either militarily or otherwise. So there's always that potential. But so far, we haven't seen any response from China. They're just sitting back and watching.
So in the short term right now, it's getting very complicated. What are the outcomes here?
Yeah, it's getting very complicated, because despite international pressure, Eritrean troops are still stationed inside Tigray, and they're still fighting alongside Ethiopian forces, and Sudanese forces are now have taken control over the Al-Fashaka territory, and Egypt is pushing Sudan toward more escalation. And then we see militias in different parts of the region fighting the regime, especially in the Benghazi region, but also in the Oromo state, like the Oromo Liberation Army is active again, and they are fighting to regain control in that region. And as I said before, the Somali and Afar Liu police are fighting alongside the border. So if nothing is done to end this conflict, if nothing is done to secure an immediate ceasefire, it could lead to the sadly disintegration of Ethiopia. So I think the African Union has been sitting back for a while now. I think they need to move very quickly to find ways to end this conflict, to find a peaceful solution to this conflict. Otherwise, if both dimensions of the conflict, the regional aspect of it and also the domestic ones, are left to continue, it can lead to a total disintegration of Ethiopia.
Any possibility of Western military intervention?
We don't know yet, but the problem is if they feel that things are that there is ongoing escalation, then they may use it as a pretext to intervene militarily in Ethiopia. so as to allow Abiy Ahmed to continue with his neoliberal project. And as we know, already a lot of thousands of troops are stationed next door in Djibouti, both US and French forces. AFRICOM has a very huge footprint in the Horn of African region. And I wouldn't be surprised if the West will intervene in a bid to protect what they see as their geopolitical interest in that region. So they are watching the situation very closely. And if there's an escalation, maybe the West can intervene militarily in Ethiopia.
Listen, this has been a huge insight to what's going on. Gwen, any last questions?
No, that was absolutely terrific. I guess it's kind of going backwards. I just maybe wanted you to comment on one thing, Farid, which is the bringing Eritrea back into the picture. And as we all know, Eritrea has a system of forced conscription that it's notorious for. So when we talked earlier about child soldiers from Somalia being trained in Eritrea and unwittingly being pulled into this conflict, can you speak to the presence of Eritrean children that have been required to be involved in this conflict?
Well, yeah, Eritrea has a long history of child child constriction and also mandatory military service for young people. And it has got away with that for a very long time. And unfortunately also, the Somali government has been recruiting child soldiers into the army, not as much as Eritrea, but that pattern is still there, which is also very worrisome. So the issue of child soldiers has always been a big issue in the Horn of Africa. It's the same with rebel groups, militias, Al-Shabaab. They all recruit child soldiers. So is a problem that has not been addressed, and international community doesn't care about the issue of child soldiers in the Horn of Africa region, and no one has done anything at the international level to try and stop this practice. So Eritrea has sent a lot of troops into Tigray region, and there are fears that a large number of them are child soldiers as well. So nothing is being done to solve this issue. So it's a serious problem for the Horn of Africa region.
Well, thanks, Farid. Really a tremendous, really a great help in your comments have helped to explain a very complex situation, but you've done it with great clarity, and we really appreciate that.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you, Farid.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Amandla. And Doug, you have something for us.
Well, Farid was so informative on the issues around what's going on in Ethiopia. But of course, one of the big dramas that had taken place in East and Central Africa at the over the last 2 weeks has been the election Feb 14th of in Uganda, heavily rigged and favored and muscled in favor of the incumbent Yoweri Museveni. But the contestant Bobby Wine was really giving him a run for his money. And I had asked Farid for his feedback, and I thought I'd start the interview with a question, but my goodness, I only had to say the word Uganda, and he went, and boy, oh boy, was he eloquent. And what really struck me, Heldon, you'll be sympathetic to this, is how he talks so much about its the youth and how that it's such a hopeful component of what's going on, that they're not going to put up with the rigging and the geriatrics holding on to power forever and ever. So, but again, just like I said last time, we'll let Fareed say it. Now, as just to remind the listeners, Fareed Omar is a longstanding member of GRILA, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa. He has contributed to AMANDA for a number of years, and he's currently in Ottawa as a consultant with NGOs and on issues of strategic policy and planning around Africa. Guess what? So stay tuned now for this interview with Fareed for his comments on what happened in Uganda and in as of the election and before and after.
Yeah, Bobi Wine coming into the scene is a very interesting new development in Uganda. As you all know, he's a rapper turned politician. And he only came into politics in 2017 during a by-election in a constituency called Iskiadondo. He won with a landslide as an independent, defeating seasoned politicians. And then last year, in July last year, in preparation for the election that took place in January this year, he joined the National Union Party, where he was elected as its president and also chosen as its flag bearer in the Ugandan elections that took place a few weeks ago. How is Bobi Wine different from other former opposition leaders like Kizza Besigye, who almost his entire life has been in opposition against Museveni, trying to bring down the Museveni government?
Oh, very courageously so. He's suffered a lot with his opposition.
Yes. During opposition, Kizza Besigye was detained many times, and also his health suffered. So he sat out this time. But Bobi Wine represents a different class of politicians. He's only 38. So he has a strong appeal for the people of Uganda. He was able to galvanize Uganda's younger generation like no other politician has done before. He was able to bring in people power into play. So we see the rise of people power and the Ugandan revolution that is still in a very nascent stage. The median age in Uganda is only 16. So mobilizing the young people is critical in terms of defeating the establishment. And Bobi Wine represents that anti-status quo. So the Ugandan people, especially the young people, found him to be very appealing, especially in his music. In the latter part of his music career, it was heavily political. One of his songs is called Ghetto, because he's originally from Ashanti town, that's where he was born. So he grew up in poverty from humble backgrounds. So the track Ghetto is about attack on the political establishment, especially the Museveni regime. And this endeared him to a lot of young people in Uganda. So he has been able to galvanize the young people and people power. So what he has to do now, the elections were largely rigged. If there were free and fair elections, there's no doubt that Bobi Wine will have won, because they made it very difficult for him to mobilize. While the Museveni had access to state resources and state media, all Bobi Wine and his followers had to rely on was Facebook and instant messaging.
They were forbidden access to radio stations and TV and everything else.
Yes. The government blocked access to Facebook and all other forms of social media, including instant messaging. But still, Bobi Wine was able to mobilize Ugandans against the establishment. And he did a lot of dents to Museveni, because if you look at the results, even though these results were doctored, Museveni won only 58% of the votes, this time around.
With all that rigging, that's all he could get.
Yes, exactly, 58%. This is in stark contrast to the first time when the elections were held in Uganda in 1996, when he won around 75%. So his numbers are going down, and Bobi Wine won about 34% of seats. And this, despite all that rigging. So he was able to do a lot of damage to the establishment. Not only that, Bobi Wine's party swept the central region, which includes Kampala and also Luwero district. Luwero district is interesting because this is where Museveni launched his guerrilla warfare.
Absolutely.
In the early 80s. So losing the Luwero district is symbolically very strong in terms of Bobi Wine putting a dent on the establishment. And Museveni sees Bobi Wine as a real threat to his long totalitarian reign, because he can see his appeal to the masses, to the people. So I think what Bobi Wine can do now is to continue to build that people movement slowly and slowly. I think next time around, the regime will fall, whether it's through election or through popular uprising. Also, what Bobi Wine demonstrated was that you no longer have to have a military background to be a national leader. Most of these national leaders, whether from government or opposition, have a military background. For example, Museveni has a military background from his days in the NRA, National Resistance Army, from his guerrilla days. Even Kesige, Kizza Besigye, people know him as a physician and a politician, but he was also a military official in the NRA, in the National Resistance Army. He had a military background. And so is Muntu Mugisha, another leading opposition leader, the leader of the Forum for Democratic Change. He was a former commander in the Uganda's armed forces. So the coming of Bobi Wine has ushered in a new era in which he has clearly illustrated that you don't have to be a leader with a military background to be a national leader. So young people in Uganda are galvanized than ever before. They are now politicized. They are demanding their rights. They are fighting for their rights. And they are rallying behind Bobi Wine. So gradually we see people power building in Uganda. And Bobi Wine, although he's still right now in house arrest, I think there is that opportunity now to build the people's movement in Uganda. I think this election has laid that foundation to build that people's power in Uganda that has been lacking for so long. With a new young leader like Bobi Wine, his original name, as you know, is Robert Kyagulanyi. So I think there is hope for the future. So what Ugandans have to do is to keep building that people's movements, and in the end, they'll be able to bring down the regime.
Well, do you think that they'll wait for the next election, or do you think that there's a degree of galvanization and people's power out in the streets that perhaps they don't want Museveni to see out this next term, given that it's broadly viewed as illegitimate?
Yes, I think given Bobi Wine's style, there'll be ongoing mobilization. The problem we had with the previous leaders, mostly they will mobilize in and around elections, former opposition leaders in Uganda. But with Bobi Wine, we saw him that since 2017, when he came in as a rookie MP, he started mobilizing on ongoing basis. Which means that from now on, he will still continue to mobilize in between elections. And there is a possibility that I think Ugandans are fed up now. They will do everything to bring back democracy to their beautiful land. So I think with Bobi Wine's style of continued mobilization, the people of Uganda will not wait for the next election. They will continue to mobilize and fight for their rights, fight to bring down corruption, fight to bring down the Museveni government. So the movement will grow from now on. And I think Ugandans will not wait for the next election. They will keep mobilizing until they bring down the regime.
That's very encouraging news, and it's good to hear it that way. So I really want to thank you once again for clear, articulate insights to a situation that has gone on and on. And while they cover Bobi Wine, they never give us the kind of background you do when you get into this. So thanks again, Farid, for all this insight.
Thanks, Farid. It was terrific.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Thanks, all. Thanks a lot.
So that just about wraps it up for us here on Amandla for this week. I'd like to thank Heldon and Doug and Farid Omar for joining us from Ottawa and giving so generously of his time. We will certainly be back next week, but stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium. Africa
Unite! What you've been listening to is a replay of our broadcast from 27 January this year. Thank you for listening to Amandla.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
It was almost love, almost something worth singing about.
Sandra Botha, her songs will touch your heart and fuel your soul. Winner of the Toronto Blues Society Talent Search, Sandra Botha is an R&B and soul singer-songwriter. Her new release, Falling Away From Me, is filled with deep grooves that reveal her sultry and soulful vocals. Catch a live online concert April 10th. Tickets and info available at sandrabouza.com.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided. It is forbidden to leave your home between 9:30 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about other measures in place to fight COVID-19. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the government.